It's Wednesday, June 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, protests are underway as Hong Kong legislators debate a pro-Beijing electoral reform plan. Billionaire Donald Trump announces his presidential candidacy. Al-Qaeda loses a key leader in a U.S. drone strike.
As far as I can see it, this sounds like the beginnings of the death knell for Al-Qaeda. I see it very difficult for Al-Qaeda to come back from this, but it does also mean that there is now a void into which ISIS can step.
And country music stars gather for their annual awards. It's all ahead. Hong Kong lawmakers are debating a contentious electoral reform bill that's backed by Beijing, but has been rejected by the territory's pro-democracy groups. Hundreds of protesters from both sides gathered outside the legislature Wednesday, with government supporters waving Chinese flags and opposition activists decrying the plan they say would lead to fake democracy. I'm joined by reporter Shannon Van Sant in Hong Kong. Shannon, Hong Kong's legislature is debating this controversial plan for electoral reform. So how is this going? What has happened there so far?
Well, the legislature is still in session, and they are under this debate over this plan, particular plan for electoral reform. And this plan is expected to continue. This debate, I should say, is expected to continue for another hour or so. We have at least over 1,000 people outside of the legislature, outside of government offices here in central Hong Kong, demonstrating both in support of the plan and against the plan. And they seem to have come out in almost equal measure. There's a very strong show of people who are, you would call, pro-Beijing or in support of this plan for electoral reform. That contingent seems to be much larger than during the protests last fall, which drew more than 100,000 people to Hong Kong streets campaigning for direct democracy and direct elections.
Is it known when the lawmakers will vote on this?
They will vote on this by Friday. This debate is expected to continue. The vote could happen even tonight, or it could be delayed until tomorrow, but the latest is by Friday. And many expect that the vote will take place on Friday. This is, of course, a very controversial plan, extremely contentious, and a lot for the legislators to debate at the moment.
What would the bill require in order to pass, to be approved?
The bill, for it to be approved, requires two-thirds of the legislature to approve it. And right now, 27 of the legislators oppose it. So for the bill to pass, they need to basically take four of those people and have four people switch sides. That looks like it's very unlikely to happen. There have been reports among some members of the legislature that they've received offers of bribes by people asking them to vote in favor of the bill. Those claims of potential bribery have not been confirmed, though. And at this point, it looks very much as if this electoral reform plan will fail.
I noticed looking on social media over the weekend that there were signs of people coming out again, and also some yellow displays of yellow umbrellas. Has that continued in the city in the last few days?
We do see umbrellas, and there have been people camping out around government offices. There are umbrellas on display, and of course those umbrellas symbolize this pro-democracy movement. Right now, though, I would say the most visual aspect of these demonstrators in front of government offices is actually in support of Beijing. Many are wearing red. Many are waving Chinese national flags. And some are wearing stickers in the shape of a heart of the Chinese national flag. So the most visible symbols right now actually appear to be from the pro-Beijing side at the moment, and they seem to be very well organized.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Shannon.
Okay, thank you.
That's Shannon Van Sant in Hong Kong. Billionaire real estate magnate Donald Trump has entered the 2016 presidential race in the United States. Trump announced his candidacy at his New York City skyscraper on Tuesday. Calling the current group of Washington politicians stupid and losers, Trump said the so-called American dream is dead. Analysts give Trump little chance of winning the nomination. I spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York about the Trump candidacy. Well, Adam, Donald Trump is a larger-than-life figure, I think, both in New York City and in the country and even maybe around the world. But he's played a sort of unique role in New York over the last few decades.
Yes, well, I mean, he definitely is a singular personality. I'll give him that much. He's quite a bit of a showman. He's an entertainer, something that, you know, was brought to the fore very much with his Apprentice show that he did, this reality show where he would fire people who didn't come up to snuff and rate being one of his senior managers. He actually gets $3 million an episode for that, making him one of the highest paid TV stars in history, actually. And he's also made a lot of money. His name is emblazoned in sort of a false gold plate on many, many huge buildings, including the Trump Tower and other places. And in China, he's also well known because he sells a lot of real estate over there, something that he proudly touted on Tuesday in his announcement that he's running for president.
So why has Trump said, you know, made this decision? Why has he decided to run for president?
Well, the very short answer, he says he's running because he's absolutely disgusted at the end of his rope with the way things are done in Washington. And he thinks that he's the man, as a successful entrepreneur and a businessman and very, very rich, something he kept reminding people of, to clean up the mess. And he has lots of very specific policy ideas for how to do that. He didn't say the nuts and bolts, but he's got some broad strokes about how we clean things up.
And so what has he said about what he would like to do if he's elected?
Well, on immigration, he said he'd build an actual wall along the entire Mexican-U.S. border. He said that he would impose huge tariffs and taxes on China so that they would come up to snuff with us. He would banish Obamacare. And he also thinks that climate change is a complete hoax and is a sort of a ruse or a conspiracy to raise taxes. And in fact, he actually sued in Scotland to block plans for wind turbines that would power 65,000 homes because he said in part they would mar the view from the golf course that he was building there.
And what has been the reaction so far to this announcement by Trump?
Truly, the reaction among everyone I've spoken to and the people who were in the newsroom was a kind of sort of amused distaste. I don't think people tend to take him very seriously. They think of him more as a kind of a self-promoting buffoon who's made a lot of money. But I suppose there are probably a segment of the Republican base that will like what he's trying to do and that like somebody who's successful no matter what. But I don't think people are really thinking that he's going to win, and I don't think they see him as a heavyweight in any sense.
Could this just be another publicity stunt?
It could very well be. That may be the secret reason why he's doing all this, because, you know, for today, for at least a couple of hours or a couple of days, people are going to be saying, you know, Trump is running. What do you think? Isn't that amazing what he said? Can you believe what he said? And, you know, it will certainly, I guess, elevate his visibility more than it's been, you know, for the last few months or even since he ran for president the last time in 2012. That was a very brief run, of course, and he dropped the ball pretty quickly.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Adam. Thanks for speaking with me today.
It's a delight. Thank you, as always, Sarah.
That's Adam Phillips reporting from New York. Now we turn to Michael Lippin, who's looking at how social media reacted to Tuesday's news that billionaire tycoon Donald Trump is entering the presidential race as a Republican candidate. Michael?
Hi, Sarah. Well, Donald Trump made quite a splash in the social media world on Tuesday. He was the number two trending item on Twitter in the United States for much of the day. He saw his Twitter following surge by several hundred thousand to the 3 million mark. He got hundreds of thousands of views on his Facebook page for a short video clip of his presidential announcement. And that's the kind of attention that many of his Republican presidential rivals would love to have. But none of them really come close, and neither can they match the billions of dollars of Trump's personal wealth. So those factors are helping Trump to be taken seriously by many of the media, and you can see that in the articles that they have posted about him. One article posted on Twitter by news website Politico talked about the 7 reasons that the Republican Party should fear, yes, fear Donald Trump. The Wall Street Journal tweeted its headline, "Donald Trump vows to disrupt crowded GOP presidential race as the 12th candidate to join the Republican primary field." But Trump is, at the end of the day, a TV and entertainment celebrity, And when someone like that enters something as serious as a U.S. presidential campaign, there is bound to be mockery. And there was plenty of that on social media, too. Time magazine tweeted a story about what it called the 8 billion reasons that Trump won't be president. And that's a reference to the $8 billion that Trump says he's worth. The New Yorker magazine tweeted a link to a satirical column about Trump, poking fun at his assertion in his campaign speech that the Islamic State militants whom he wants to defeat have built a hotel in Syria, competition perhaps for Trump, who has his own global hotel empire. Well, in the New Yorker piece by comedian Andy Borowitz, he claims to have interviewed an Islamic State spokesman who says the militants were confused by Trump's hotel analogies and couldn't understand how they fit into Trump's strategy to defeat their group. And that Islamic State confusion, Borowitz wrote, prompted Trump to quickly claim that he was already winning the war against it. Okay, Trump didn't actually say that, and there were no actual Islamic State comments, but the mocking of Trump has begun and is sure to go on as long as he stays in the race. Sarah?
That's Michael Lippin. This is VOA.
Several studies conducted with data gathered by NASA's Curiosity rover suggested that Mars may have once been warm and wet, with an abundance of water flowing over its surface. But now, scientists at Harvard University say that after running several possible scenarios on a computer model, they've found evidence that quite the opposite is true. They say that early in its history, the red planet may have actually been quite cold, with an average global temperature of minus 48 degrees Celsius. Martian water that existed then would have been in the form of ice. A lack of sunshine may have been a factor. The red planet today gets only about 43% as much of the sun's energy as Earth does. And eons ago, a young sun may have delivered even less, only about 25% of what it does today. The researchers also say that signs of water damage and erosion near Mars' equator can be explained by an extreme tilt the planet once had in its axis. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, country music stars celebrate their achievements. Al-Qaeda said Tuesday that Nasser al-Wuhayshi, its deputy chief and the leader of its potent Yemen branch, was killed in a U.S. drone strike last week. In a video statement, the group said Friday's strike in the southeastern port city of Mukalla killed Wuhayshi and two others. It named Qasem al-Raimi as the new leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Benedict Wilkinson is a research fellow and lecturer in defense studies at King's College London. He spoke to me about Wuhayshi. What is known about his role in al-Qaeda?
Well, he's a key al-Qaeda player. He first came onto the scene in a big way in Yemen. He was part of a major prison break in 2006. He quickly rose up through the ranks as part of that prison break, and eventually in probably mid-2006 took on the leadership of what would become al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is al-Qaeda's most violent, vociferous franchise over the last few years. It has explicitly looked to attack the US and to attack the West, as well as operating in Yemen. And a lot of this comes down to Nasser al-Wahishi's sort of strategic vision for the region.
Is it known what he had been involved in say, recently, and maybe in the most recent years?
Yeah, so from about mid-2013, Wahishi took on a sort of wider leadership role within the broader al-Qaeda movement. So he operated both in Yemen as the de facto leader of AQAP, but he also took on the leadership of the wider al-Qaeda movement. He was the deputy leader operating directly beneath Ayman al-Zawahiri, who himself took over from bin Laden.
So where, at the moment, where would this then leave al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula?
Well, I think that's the really key question, isn't it? I mean, that's the most important aspect of this is that, from my perspective as I see it, this sounds the death knell for al-Qaeda. Al-Wahishi was the kind of last of the old guard who was looking to attack the West. that brought with it a certain amount of kudos. It brought him the ability to recruit people to bring them into Yemen. The death of Wehaishi is a really big win for counterterrorism against al-Qaeda. And this, as far as I can see it, this sounds like the beginnings of the death knell for al-Qaeda. I see it very difficult for al-Qaeda to come back from this. But it does also mean that there is now a void into which ISIS can step.
That was another thing I was going to ask you, is the connection or relations between ISIS and al-Qaeda.
There is a link between them. So they share aspects of ideology. They share aspects of similar strategies. They have at times cooperated, particularly in Yemen. There is an ISIS branch reputedly operating in Yemen, but they have never been the same organization. They are different organizations, and there has obviously been great deal of animosity between ISIS and al-Qaeda in the form of the al-Nusra Front in Syria and Iraq. But al-Qaeda were the older of the two, and in some ways the more widely, are widely perceived now to be the more moderate. But with the death of Wehaishi, I don't see how al-Qaeda really managed to regain the limelight, recapture the oxygen of publicity. I think that there will be a gap in the wider kind of violent Islamist movement, and I think ISIS will seek to step into that. So they will seek to operate in new territories, Yemen being, I think, a very key focus for them. I think it's interesting they've already got operatives on the ground there. So the death of Wehaishi is a win for counterterrorism in that it means that al-Qaeda will be severely limited. And, you know, as I keep on saying, it probably sounds that the end, really, of al-Qaeda. But it does mean that ISIS becomes an even greater threat.
Benedict Wilkinson, research fellow at King's College London. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Country music had a big awards night recently. David Byrd and Nikki Strong are in the studio to tell us more about the winners.
Carrie Underwood, Tim McGraw, all of the top stars of country music were at the CMT Awards, that's Country Music Television, which is where they hand out awards for the best videos of the year. Carrie Underwood won one of those awards. Actually, she took home more than one. To talk about that and the rest of the show, VOA's Nikki Strong is in the studio. Nikki, Carrie cleaned up for Something in the Water.
Yeah, Carrie did very well. She dominated the event. The buzz was all around her. This was her first performance since she had the baby. People wanted to see what she looked like, and she didn't disappoint. She looked fantastic. And she also cleaned up, so she took home three awards. She took home Video of the Year for Something in the Water. She also took home Female Video of the Year for Something in the Water, a song that I love that's also gotten some recognition on the gospel side because of its lyrical content. It's a beautiful video with people dancing while she's singing, and they're dancing in the water. Beautiful. I love it. One thing I love about the CMT Awards is that it is fan-driven. The fans vote for it, and I love that video. So to see it win, I was like, yes, yes, go fans, even though I didn't vote. And she also picked up another award for Collaborative Video of the Year with Miranda Lambert.
For Something Bad.
For Something Bad.
Talk about two ends of the spectrum.
Exactly.
Wow.
She was awesome. So she was awesome. And apparently, not only did she continue her streak as the longest running Video of the Year winner at the CMT Awards, but she is now the most awarded artist in CMT Music Awards history. So she has a total of 13 awards right now.
So Carrie dominated the women's category. Who's the big winner for the guys?
Well, I mean, it ranged. I think you had Luke Bryan played again. He did well for Male Video of the Year. Wasn't surprised about that. Lady Antebellum won for Group Video of the Year. Florida Georgia Line for Best Duo for their video Dirt. And the CMT Performance of the Year went to Turn the Page, Bob Seger, and Jason Aldean. And then the Breakthrough Video of the Year was Leave the Night On, Sam Hunt.
Sam Hunt is lighting up stuff. He's got another song on the charts now, too.
Yes, he does, called Take Your Time.
Take Your Time. He's like almost rapping through most of it. He's like,
I know
it is, you know, here's your friends, guys, it stay too long. You know,
yes.
He only sings just a little bit. And it's like, you know, here comes one of your friends because he's supposed to rescue you from guys who want to talk too much.
Yes.
You know, it's like he's talking to a woman in a bar.
Exactly. But one thing I love about it, I'm not surprised that he won Breakthrough Video of the Year, because even for his video for Take Your Time, it's basically, you hear the song, it's about a guy who's trying to pretty much talk to a woman, but he doesn't want to come on too strong. But in the video, he does an interesting take, and it's about domestic violence. And so, yes, it takes a stand against domestic violence, and it tells the story of a young woman who at one point endeavors to break away from her abuser.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that's a flip.
Yeah, it was a flip, and I like the way it's done. It's done really well.
All right, that's VOA's Nikki Strong. You can hit Nikki up on Twitter at @VOA_music. You can also catch her on Country Hits USA. That's at voanews.com.
That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
5 years ago, Burma, newly emerging from 5 decades of military rule, started moving toward an increasingly democratic rule. According to senior U.S. government officials, Assistant Secretary for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor Tom Malinowski, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for East Asian and Pacific Affairs Scott Marcial, and Assistant Administrator for USAID Jonathan Stivers, in testimony before the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee on June 11th, Burma is undergoing an evolution, not a revolution, with each step carefully negotiated between representatives of its old and new orders. Burma is still dealing with the multiple legacies of its former dictatorship, one of the world's longest-running armed conflicts, a constitution that grants the military extraordinary powers, and ethnic and religious tensions that cannot be addressed in a closed society and that irresponsible political forces can exploit in a society that is opening. This is an important year for Burma, which will hold a national election in November. A successful transition to democracy will depend on the government's continued dialogue with civil society, ethnic groups, and the political opposition to build trust and foster national reconciliation. Constitutional amendments to reduce the military's role in the civilian government and improve the people's ability to elect leaders of their choice, and additional measures to protect the rights of members of ethnic and religious minorities. The country is ethnically diverse, with 135 officially recognized ethnic nationalities and a history of ethnic conflict. The humanitarian situation in Rakhine State remains grim, and we continue to underscore with the Burmese government the importance of addressing the root causes driving Rohingya migrants to leave their country. The Burmese government has begun to take steps to resolve some of the long-standing problems, including engaging in negotiations with ethnic armed groups in the country. In his testimony before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Assistant Secretary Malinowski noted that it is critical that the parties engage in an inclusive, transparent, and meaningful political dialogue that addresses long-standing differences. The United States, in coordination with other members of the international community, will continue to support the peace process going forward. This is an opportunity for Burma to set an example of peaceful transition to democracy for other countries in the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.